Hi, I'm Laura Lee.
And I'm Jenny.
We're the hosts of Eat Like a Heroine, a podcast that exists because, hey, a girl's got to eat. She may as well eat like a heroine. Eat Like a Heroine reveals a whole new layer to the books you thought you knew by heart and will make you fall in love all over again in a tangible, delicious way. Inspired by my recent trip to Little House in the Prairie, this episode will be devoted to Laura Ingalls Wilder and especially the food she ate in the book Little House on the Prairie, which is really, again, an ode to food. But they ate much differently than they did in the big woods. On the way to Kansas and in Kansas, they had far less ingredients and cooking was much more challenging. There was so much cornbread and sweet molasses, so much molasses. Also in this book, one of the sweetest Christmas vignettes ever committed to the page, heart-shaped cakes, anyone? There's a whole lot to love about food eaten at the Little House on the Prairie.
Okay, so Laura Lee, you just went back to this Little House site that you and I visited together 3 years ago. I can't believe it's been 3 years.
Yes, we did.
That was in 2020. Yeah. We have a whole episode about it. If you haven't listened to it, definitely go back and do that. That's the one where we laughed the most. Laughed till we cried. I cried anyway.
Yes. It was very funny because just a tiny little recap. The gift shop lady was very enthused about Almanzo Wilder. And to the point where neither Jenny or I will ever be able to pry it out of our minds.
Tremendous
enthusiasm.
Also because it's just become like folklore in Laura Lee and Jenny's history. Like, I'm pretty sure it's been exaggerated like tenfold, but that's okay. It's now legend.
Oh, I don't know about that. She was pretty darn enthusiastic about Almanzo. That's quite a name. It's kind of a sexy name almost, isn't it?
Well, when she said it,
you know.
Yeah.
Oh, when she said it, it was definitely sexy.
But you said that. She wasn't there when you went back.
That special lady was not there. No, she was absent. And I was kind of looking forward to having a repeat of that, you know.
Yeah.
Enthusiasm for Almanzo. But anyway, there was a young gal in the gift shop and her and I chatted and she told me something that I thought was awesome. She said that in light of Killers of the Flower Moon, both the book and the movie, that they had started not only carrying Killers of the Flower Moon, but also other books by Indigenous authors, and that they were working with a local Osage to tell the complete story of, you know, what happened in that area with the settlers and with the Osage. And I thought that was fantastic development and, you know, hats off to Little House on the Prairie for, you know, for trying to tell the whole story. I think that's great. Mm.
So how many times have you visited that site now?
So that was my second time.
Oh, it was?
And I thought as you had know, been... my... Yeah.
Okay.
No, I've been to Little House in the Big Woods like a million times.
Okay, that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
Then. Okay.
And then I've been to Walnut Grove, Minnesota. So
that's right.
On the banks of Plum Creek, right? And that's a whole production. Wow. Someday we have to go together because... That is like almost like Six Flags over a Little House on the Prairie. It's just,
oh, wow.
It's very developed and the whole town, and they have a pageant.
Oh, that's right.
And everything. So it's kind of crazy.
So funny.
But one thing we did want to bring up. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say the one we're talking about is the one in Independence, Kansas. And it is a quiet little fields, basically, with the log cabin. It's not the original log cabin, but a schoolhouse and a few other things. But it's a quiet site.
It's a very peaceful place. And I love visiting there. And now I've brought my husband twice. So I don't know how many more times
He's a good sport, and he enjoys learning about the history of the area and stuff like mm-hmm. that. But one thing we wanted to say about that site in Independence, Kansas, is Cary Ingalls was actually born there. And the day that Jenny and I were there in 2000 was actually Cary's 150th birthday.
Yes. That's right. Yes.
Yes.
We were there in 2020. Yeah.
Yeah, we were there actually on her birthday. So the lady in the gift shop did not say a word about Cary because she was
that's right.
We found that with Almanzo, apparently.
Mm-hmm. That's the only explanation. She had one person on her mind.
I know. And what I found out recently, like very recently, I've been reading the book Prairie Fire by Carolyn Fraser. And it's absolutely a masterwork of nonfiction. And I believe when it came out, it won multiple awards and was on a lot of the best of the year lists. But anyway, she's an incredible writer, an incredible historian and researcher. And she said, which I never knew before, that Dr. Tan, who saves the family from malaria, the black doctor that is in the book, he also delivered Cary.
That's right. I had forgotten about that because I read Prairie Fires. It's been a few years now, but I loved it. It is a tome. It is so full of information, but I learned so much.
Yeah, I can't really put it down. Like every night I'm reading 50 pages a night and I'm really into it. And
I really love
So I hope part. To finish it before the end of the year.
Yeah, I loved the parts explaining Rose's relationship with Laura as they wrote the books. I didn't know that whole series was Rose's idea and how she, like that series would not have happened without Rose, who was a very dominant figure. In her writing career. I know we could have a whole episode on their like mother-daughter relationship because.
Oh, boy.
So interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think I haven't gotten to that part yet. But from what I know, I think the rose colored glasses come off about Rose. So she's kind of an interesting, complicated figure in all of this.
She is. But, she's very complex.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So speaking of Rose, her grandmother, Ma Caroline, she never really used recipes.
That's right.
And we know that, like, my own grandmother never measured anything. But in the book by the Shores of Silver Lake, somebody named Reverend Stewart said, would you mind writing it down, meaning a recipe? How much flour? How much milk? Goodness, said Ma. I never measure, but I guess I can take a stab at it.
That's wild.
So I thought that was kind of interesting, right? I mean, now today we just measure everything. And, you know, maybe for a family recipe or a recipe that we know really well, we don't. You know, we may have committed the measurements to memory, but I think in those days, you know, home cooks, they really did not measure the way that we do.
Well, Ma also didn't have an oven with knobs. So that to me, I mean, I just think
it was knob free
cooking. I can't even imagine. So yeah. Just because like they didn't have oven temperature, you know, like even if they had directions, it wouldn't have said 350 degrees or whatever, because they weren't gauging that. So I think cooking was just a much more intuitive process all around. I mean, just you would be going off of a lot of instincts, the texture, you know, like the consistency of what you're making. Like, oh, I guess it needs a little more flour because it's too sticky. And I don't think the fire is quite hot enough because it's not rising fast enough. And that's all they were used to. I can't imagine cooking that way now.
Yeah, no, me neither. It sounds very difficult. And for them, it was just like, you know, a simple Tuesday. They would just do this every day. And for us, it would be like, you know, I remember when I was in high school, I went on a wilderness camping expedition in Manitoba, where I'm from. And I mean, that for me, Oh my gosh, I'll never forget it. We had to dig our own toilets and then together wood for a covering, and then we dug a hole for like the milk or something, and we were forever lashing wood. And so for me, that was the closest I've ever come to Little House on the Prairie. But and we did cook over an open fire, and you know, that is different. And some people really enjoy camping and cooking while they camp, and some people do not.
And which camp do you fall into, Lorelei?
Oh, good one, Jenny. Yeah, I think we can all guess, but I do think it's fun to read about. And out of all the books, Jenny, this one I think has the most coverage of what it was like to travel in a covered wagon and cook over a campfire. And from Prairie Fire, I learned that the Ingalls family would have traveled in a very sort of rustic farm wagon. It wasn't like one of the expensive Conestoga wagons that we might have seen on, you know, movies or whatever. It was just a really primitive kind of farm wagon. And they have some examples. They have a couple of replicas of the wagons at the home site. And also from Prairie Fire, I learned that they would have traveled 10 to 20 miles per day. That's it.
And that's like what I travel.
Resting on Sundays.
Yeah. That's how far I travel to get to the grocery store.
I know. Isn't that crazy when you think of it that way?
I know. And then resting on Sundays, they literally spent the whole day. And I remember one scene, maybe it was from Caroline by Sarah Miller that I'm thinking of, that scene where they're in the wagon on a Sunday and it's raining. So they literally just they're sitting on top of their luggage in this tiny wagon all day. They can't travel because it's Sunday, and they also can't amuse themselves. They played Cat's Cradle. Does that ring a bell? Do you remember?
Yes, I think it does. And that sounds awful.
I know.
Oh, that was one of the many really challenging things about being a pioneer. Mm-hmm. These wagons would have been 10 feet long, 4 feet wide, and a couple of feet deep. And that's not very big.
No. Mm-mm. I mean, yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that's like longer than my bed and much narrower. So that's, if you think of it in terms of like a mattress, that's not big at all.
No, that's a great way to think of it, as a mattress, and even smaller than a mattress. So as far as cooking, it could only hold the essentials, and it was covered with a heavy canvas cover that was stretched over the bows and rubbed with linseed oil to try and waterproof it. And I'm sure it was not completely waterproofed either. I also read that it was extremely dangerous to travel this way and crossing rivers and creeks. And I know in this book, there's a very dramatic scene of them crossing the creek and almost drowning.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very dangerous. And apparently children fell out of the wagons all the time. And the whole route was just, there were crosses along the way marking where people had died. Mm-hmm. So very dangerous. And but yet so many of the pioneers, you know, including my ancestors, used this method of travel to, you know, to get where they were going. And to, yeah, just, it's very hard to imagine now.
It is. It's hard to wrap your mind around it. I was going to say that was normal, but that really wasn't. I mean, so few people in the grand scheme of things were actually doing this, but Laura highlights it. So, you know.
Yes. And it was very, you know, like I've said, it was very challenging. And this is a quote from Prairie Fire. Everything was a challenge. The wretched jolting of the wagon, the constant wind and dust, the search for water, cooking over an open campfire.
Mm-hmm.
So that sounds awful. The wretched jolting of the wagon.
Yeah.
You know, all day, every day. So it's no wonder like people lost their minds sometimes with all the the challenges of nature and crossing the country in this way.
Well, and also just how much the Ingalls family in particular, how often they had to settle and then pick up and move. And I know that she talks a little bit about that in Prairie Fires. She's a little bit critical of Pa, of Charles Ingalls. I think she kind of, I think she does a good job of not over inserting her own opinions. She's just laying out the facts, but there's just a little bit of like, I don't know, maybe he was a little irresponsible, like taking his family.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. He was doing things that he didn't have enough information. Yeah, we can get into that, but.
Yes, we will get into that. But he really put them in danger. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, we think of Little House on the Prairie as being just so cozy and sweet and nostalgic, but really Pa and other pioneers too, they put their families in danger, and it was sort of nothing ventured, nothing gained kind of mindset, I guess. And but yet in this case, they left Wisconsin and they left the little house in the big woods, which was comparatively very comfortable compared to what they were facing. They were completely facing the unknown, and they had family there. They had crops there. They were settled. They had enough to eat. And here on the road to Kansas, it was back to open fire cookery, and you know, for Ma, and she had a cook stove in Pepin in the little house in the big woods. But here, especially en route, she could only bring portable pans and utensils with her. So she packed her iron bake oven and her spider pan.
That's right.
And that's a fun thing to look at, isn't it, Jenny, at the Little House on the Prairie?
It is. Ma's actual spider pan.
We kind of geeked out about that. Yeah.
It wasn't actually her actual
spider pan. Well, maybe it was. No, if it was, no. It would be stolen, I'm sure.
Right. It wouldn't be sitting out.
It was a spider pan.
Yeah.
But a spider pan is a pan with legs. So it keeps it out of the coals, and it sort of raises it up. And that's why it's called a spider pan, because it has legs.
Mm-hmm.
So another thing that they would have brought is a Dutch bake oven. And here is a quote from Scribner's Monthly in May of 1880. Sometimes the cook used the Dutch bake oven, which everyone knows. I didn't know, but anyway, a shallow iron pot with close fitting iron cover on which you can pile great thickness of coals, or you can build a miniature fire. So I think that's funny, which everyone knows. Because apparently now we don't know.
Well, he says a Dutch bake oven. Is that just what we call a Dutch oven? Although I don't think of a Dutch oven as being shallow. I have two and they are quite deep. So I wonder if they must be related. But if it's shallow enough to cover with coals, that's not what I have in my kitchen.
Right, right. Yeah, I don't know. Or maybe this was a version of the Dutch oven that we think of today. So in Little House on the Prairie, Ma's primary cooking vessels are the coffee pot, the spider pan, and the bake oven. All three were suitable for cooking over an open fire. Set among the hot coals of an open fire, additional coals could be raked against the bake oven's sides. Its lid had a deep flange around the top, creating a container where hot coals could be placed. This allowed for all surfaces of the vessel to be heated, which baked the food from all sides. So that's interesting. And that's a quote from the Little House on the Prairie website.
But I feel like we should all
very interesting.
Notes. Yes. But just because you owned those three things did not a good cook make you. Could I have said that more awkwardly? But
I don't think so.
A nod to Ma's creativity here and intuitive cooking skills, because like we said, she was faced with challenges and she was able to cook some really decent meals there out on the road.
I know. She was actually amazing in terms of her resourcefulness. As Prairie Fires points out, Pa had already traversed the country coming from New York State to Wisconsin, but Ma had never been on one of these long distance jaunts before. So this for her was totally new and she had no experience whatsoever. And yet she took up the challenge and I mean, she had to cook for them and they had to eat. So she, you know, stopped by the side of the road and cooked food. It's pretty amazing.
It is.
So Little House on the Prairie is chronologically the second book in the series, the first book being Little House in the Big Woods. It was the third novel published, which is a little confusing, but it's not related to the second novel. Thus, it is sometimes called the second one in the series or the second volume of The Laura Years. And the novel is about the months that the Ingalls spent on the Kansas prairie around the town of Independence. And Laura describes how her father built their one-room log house in Indian Territory, having heard rumors that the government planned to open the territory to white settlers soon. And as we said before, Carrie was born there in August, August 3rd, if I'm remembering correctly. And only a few weeks after her birth, they were forced to leave the territory. And however, in the novel, I don't think she's even in the novel at all, is she?
And no, in Little House on the Prairie, I don't think so.
No, I don't. I think she's talked about in future novels, but even though she was born, I don't know why. I mean, that's an interesting choice on Laura's part not to mention that her sister was born there too. I mean,
they talk
although
about
there
that,
was plenty of drama.
Yes, she talks about that in Prairie Fires, why they made that choice, but I cannot think of what that was now. Maybe you haven't gotten to that part.
I have not gotten to that point either, but it's interesting that Carrie was born there, but she was just a few weeks old when they pulled up stakes and left again. They were on the move again.
Ugh.
And here's where we get into some sticky wickets. Laura Ingalls Wilder stated that her father, Charles, had been told that the Kansas Territory would soon be up for settlement. But their homestead, which it really wasn't a homestead, it was a cabin that was built, was on an Osage Indian reservation. And Charles's information was incorrect. So the Ingalls had no legal right to occupy their cabin. Quoting from Prairie Fires by Carolyn Fraser, 13 miles south of the fledgling town, Charles Ingalls pulled up his wagon and camped on land he had not bought. He intended on making it his own. So that's an example of her critiquing Pa in this book. And the Osage were on a hunting expedition at this time when the Ingalls arrived, so the land seemed deserted. But according to Carolyn Fraser, Pa must have known that he was playing a very dangerous game. And that is something that you and I have talked about a few times, Jenny, like how Laura describes what was going on versus, you know, what was really going on. And she tends to, I mean, we all love Pa. Pa was a great guy, but, you know, very lovable in the books, very cheerful and playing his fiddle and everything. But yet, you know, he was literally playing a very dangerous game, as Carolyn Fraser says, and just kind of his need for adventure and his need for, you know, being somewhere where no one had been before or no white people, I guess, it just sort of really spurred him on from one place to another.
Yeah. And I think in this book in particular, that really shines because to me, this book is so heartbreaking like you said earlier, that they had to, like, they left all of Ma's family, and she thought she mm-hmm. might never see them. I mean, it was a possibility that she might never see them again, or at least it would be many, many years. And then they leave on this very arduous journey, and they end up only staying for 1 year before they basically lose everything and have to turn back and go home. So it's complicated, but also the fact that Charles, whenever they got there to this site where they were going to build the house, Pa knew that Indians had lived there because there were signs of it. And he said, oh, they must be off on a hunting expedition right now. So I think, it's hard to judge somebody through the eyes of one perspective. We don't know all that was going on in his head, but just the fact that, like, I just think that his love of adventure definitely clouded his judgment at times. And I think there's a lot we could get into. Like, Laura adored him. He was a loving father. But then that's something mm-hmm. that is talked about in Prairie Fires as well, is like, but would a good father do all the, like, take such risks with his family? So I think it's an mm-hmm. interesting question to consider.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting question. And another thing we've talked about is, in this book, you know, Laura as an author makes choices about what she, you know, what dialogue she puts in whose mouth. And, you know, some of the things that are said about the Osage are difficult to read and painful to read. And, you know, I hope that any parents reading this, you know, with their child would discuss these things, and you know, in the context of what we know now, that the Ingalls family really was on Osage land, and they were there illegally. So that's a difficult truth. But I think that she, at one point in the book, Jenny, she says something like, Laura, the character, says, why are we here if it's Indian territory? If it's, mm-hmm. I mean, how does she put it again?
Yes, she's asking, it's at night, Paul's playing his fiddle, and she's in bed, like, kind of thinking things over. And she says, yes, why are we here if this is Indian territory? And the answer is something simple like, well, they're going to move west, as if that's just what they do, which is
right.
An odd answer. And then Laura keeps pressing it and says, but if it's their land, why are we here? And Pa says, no more questions, good night. And that's how the chapter yeah. ends, which we talked a little bit about this, but I think that's a very, I don't know what the word is. What word am I trying to say? A sensitive way, I guess, maybe to that. Mm-hmm. I respect that Laura is not using her ability. She's an adult writing these books, and she has a little more context historically, not as much as we have, but she had more than she did at that time. So yeah. I respect that she's able to, like, keep it on a child's level, which, by asking these childlike questions, which are actually very good questions and questions that people ask 100 years later. So, or not even that long. But so I think it's good that in a children's book, you really can't get into all the nuances of these things. But the fact that she brings it up, and the fact that her loving, adoring father that she clearly admires cuts her off at this, I just think that, mm-hmm. I don't know exactly what she's trying to say there, but I think it's an interesting choice on her part.
Yeah, and I'm so glad she included that in the book. And, you know, we all wonder, what was she thinking? How was she judging her parents in some ways? And obviously, she polished her father to a deep shine. I have no doubt that he was a great guy, cheerful, loving father, but she really kind of softened some of his choices. And, mm-hmm. You know, and in later books as well, when the family nearly starves to death, you know, some of these things are a result of his choices. And, but this book is really action-packed, and there's a lot of things that happen in this book. And it's not only the threat of the Osage, who are, of course, understandably furious that the settlers are on their land. And I think the Ingalls family, if I remember correctly, they were 3 miles over the line. So they were they were in the Osage Reservation. So mm-hmm. 3 miles, you know, beyond where they should have been. Mm-hmm. And so the Osage were furious. But yet in the book, there is that one Osage chief that basically convinces the other Osage not to attack the settlers. And so the Ingalls family are spared from that. But they do go through many things in this book. Besides that, their lives are first endangered when the creek they are crossing rises without warning. And that's like a death-defying scene.
It is. It's terrifying, especially with the Jack element, because you think that they've lost their beloved dog. And mm-hmm. yeah, it's harrowing to read about, oh, crossing a creek. This sounds awful.
Yeah. And you know what I wish? I wish that some incredible filmmaker somewhere would make a series really based on the books, because the TV show, as beloved as it was barely based on the books. And there's nothing from this episode in their lives, this Kansas episode. There's nothing of that in the series.
Wait, there
is,
though.
I would love to see.
Did you? The pilot episode. The pilot episode.
The pilot episode?
Yes. It's called, I've looked it up recently because it's just a 1 hour pilot. And it's, it has this scene where they're crossing the creek and that you think that they've lost Jack.
Okay. Well, I stand corrected. I don't remember that at all.
Yeah. I believe it's the pilot episode, but it's.
Okay.
Yeah, and it sticks pretty well in my memory. It sticks pretty close to this book. But then from that point on, yeah. It's just kind of whatever they want to talk about, basically.
Yeah, honestly. Wasn't there an episode with clowns or something?
Oh, yes. Oh, so many things. Oh, they go so off the rails. So many new characters, so many new family members. It's definitely fan fiction.
Yeah, it was fan fiction all the way. And I don't know. People sort of defend it because it's wholesome, but I don't know. In my mind, it would be wonderful if they did it, you know, if they did a remake, not exactly a remake, but just some sort of limited series on Netflix or something with all of these things, right? The yeah. wolf pack, the poisonous gas, right? That when Pa dug the well.
That's right.
Who was it? The neighbor, right?
Yes, it was. Oh, was it Mr. Scott?
I can't remember the neighbor's name. Yes. Mr. Scott, very good. A+, Jenny. But Pa dug a well, and that well, that exact well that Pa dug is still there. So mm-hmm. that is something very authentic that you can see at that home site. They almost died of malaria.
That's right.
And that's a very dramatic episode in the book, right? And if it wasn't for Dr. Tan, who was an African-American doctor living very close to them, they would have all died. But he saved their lives. And I mm-hmm. love that story. And this time when I was in Independence, me and my family, I made a point to go to the cemetery in Independence where the gift shop gal told me that Dr. Tan is buried.
Oh, that's so cool.
So I actually saw his grave and spent a few minutes there just thinking about like what an incredible life story he must have had.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, he was a doctor to the settlers and also to the Native Americans that live there. So he must have had an incredible life story as well.
Yeah.
And I hope someday that somebody tells that story.
Yeah, now I want to research and see, like, what does history know about? Like, do we know more about him than what Laura tells us? You would think.
I know.
I'll have to look into that.
Yeah. Like, what? I mean, a pioneer in every way, really. And so very, very interesting and wonderful that their lives were saved. What else happened? They had malaria. There was a wolf pack. There was a fire in the chimney.
Oh, that's right.
Do you remember that? Yeah.
But how did
that
start?
There was a panther.
I do. Yes. The panther There was a prairie fire.
That's terrifying to me. For some reason, wolves, I know they're dangerous, but they look so much like dogs, right? But a panther, oh my goodness.
Like, oh, I find them equally terrifying. If I met a panther or a wolf out in the wild, I would, not be thrilled.
I'm sorry for laughing, but I'm just picturing you, like little Red Riding Hood, right? In the woods with a basket. Suddenly, skipping. Jenny comes across a wolf who wants to eat her. Then there was the prairie fire as well.
Yes.
And then, of course, there was always the threat of an Indian massacre and, which was averted. But according to a writer who has a blog called Literary Mama, she says they're nearly killed on average about every 43 pages. And it's not so funny, true.
But put it in page perspective. Yeah, that's a lot.
I wonder.
Yeah, and that's just one book in this series. We haven't even gotten to The Long Winter.
The Long Winter is... Yeah, we have to do The Long Winter. I love The Long Winter. It's probably my favorite.
Is it?
So, yeah, I think so. Just because I'm from such a cold place, Winnipeg, right? I can relate to just being that cold and that, although I can't really relate at all, to what they went through. But I certainly can relate to great blizzards and being shut in and those kinds of things.
Yes.
So they survived all these near catastrophes. And then after a year, they ultimately come to terms with the fact that they built their home 3 miles over the line into Indian territory and will be forced by the government to leave. And the canvas cover goes back on the wagon and the Ingalls leave everything behind.
And Ma's glass windows, that also breaks my heart, because this is the book where Pa gives her the glass windows for the log cabin. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were a fortune. And they make all the difference, of course. And so tearing that that down, I'm sure they took the windows. I don't remember. They probably took them back with them. But ugh. Well, you don't think of those things as a kid, or at least I wasn't thinking about how heartbreaking this whole thing was.
Right. And they put a lot of work into it and then they had to leave. So then it was on to, after that, Plum Creek. So that's a whole nother book. But for today, we're going to talk about the food that is in Little House on the Prairie, now that we've set the stage with everything that happened in the book. So what was the number one meal? What's number one on our list of foods that they ate?
We have fried cornmeal mush, which sounds so appetizing. let's see. So a quote from the book: breakfast was ready. When Pa came back from the creek, they all sat down by the fire and ate fried mush and prairie chicken hash. Pa said he would make a door that day. He wanted more than a quilt between them and the wolves next time.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, wouldn't we all?
Not to mention the panther.
Right. So fried mush and prairie chicken hash.
So cornmeal mush is hasty pudding. And this is from, I have a recipe here from laurassweetmemories.com. It's also a shop in Mansfield, Missouri, where Laura and Almanzo lived when they were married and where she died. And fried mush is hasty pudding that has been chilled in slices and fried in fat.
Okay, so that's probably not that bad.
No, I'm sure it's good. I'm sure it's good. It's just kind of like porridge that's been fried, I would think,
Yes.
So here are the ingredients: prepared gruel, which sounds very Dickensian, right? Like Oliver Twist. all-purpose flour, butter. After making a batch of gruel, place it into a greased loaf pan, refrigerate it overnight. Then slice it into half-inch slices. Melt some butter in a frying pan. Simply fry up the slices, turning to brown both sides. serve yeah. warm. And this man who calls himself the old man in the bib overalls, which just seems so perfect for someone who would be sharing recipes on a Laura Ingalls Wilder site, right?
It does.
He says, you may wish to make this as a side dish with eggs. I like this with molasses drizzled on top. Of course he does. Because seems like a very old-fashioned guy. And he also says, this is so cute. Frida, Almanzo's cousin, told me that her uncle liked to fry this up in bear grease. And bear grease is in capital letters. I don't know what this meal will do for you, but I'd be sure glad to hear if you'll come back here and leave a comment, especially if you fry it up in bear grease. Thanks, the old man in the bib overalls.
Were there any comments from people who used bear grease, is my question.
I didn't see any, no. I don't know. Maybe we should try. I don't know if I'm willing to just deal with bear grease.
I wouldn't even know where to begin to find it. I have used... I've used duck fat and okay. beef tallow.
Okay.
But those are from my grocery store. I don't know where.
What kind of modern pioneer are you?
Well, I do have a stove with knobs, so pretty okay. modern.
Okay. Pretty modern, but no bear grease.
No.
Actually, I might have a source of bear grease.
Oh, now you tell me. Where?
I know. Now, I just thought of this, but my cousin in Manitoba, his daughter, who is my daughter's age, so like 18, she shot a big old black bear.
What?
Yeah, she's a hunter.
Oh, wow.
And there's this picture of her with this giant bear head. And I'm just like, what in the world? So this is my actual relative. So,
oh, my goodness.
Who knows? Who knows? Then. I might be able to purloin some bear grease.
Let us know in the next episode.
All right. So next on our list of foods in Little House on the Prairie is cornbread.
Okay. So another quote from the book, Ma rolled up her sleeves and washed her hands and mixed cornbread while Mary brought the wood and Laura set the table. Ma made the cornmeal and water into two thin loaves, each shaped in a half circle. She laid the loaves with their straight sides together in the bake oven, and she pressed her hand flat on top of each loaf. Pa always said he did not ask any other sweetening when Ma put the prints of her hands on the loaves.
Aww.
That is...
You know, they really did love each other.
They did.
It was a real love story, which is definitely one in the plus column, and... they were very devoted to one another, and it's very sweet, that quote.
It makes me wonder what would happen if my own daughter wrote a memoir about her life in the context of me and like our family. I mean, I feel like these are real people that were at the mercy of their daughter and granddaughter's hand when it came to portraying them for the rest of history, for the rest of time.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And they had no idea.
Yeah.
So this is from the Little House Cookbook, which is just such an incredible source of information about food in all the books. And it's by Barbara Walker, who says, cornbread, corn cakes, and game carry the Ingallses through their year on the Kansas prairie. The ingredients were always the same, cornmeal, salt, and water. And they often ate it with molasses. And there was just so much molasses in this book. And we're going to talk about molasses in a minute. And also, sometimes they ate it with prairie hen gravy. Ooh. And so I went into this kind of thinking prairie hens were like chickens, right? You think chickens when you hear hens, of course, but really they were when I look them up, and we'll put this in the show notes, but prairie hens are like, they're very exotic looking, and they don't really look like chickens at all, and they're kind of pretty, and not that chickens are not pretty for the chicken people out there, but it was more of a grouse than a chicken. And apparently, though this North American species was once abundant, it's become extremely rare and extirpated. There's a $5 word for you, over much of its range due to habitat loss. So the prairie hens that, you know, that the Ingleses were eating are not really available anymore.
Yes, I looked up a picture too, and I don't know, I'm sure we saw the same ones, but they look like they have swallowed an orange and it's been lodged in their throats. And if their neck was see-through, it's like they have this bulbous orange thing like stuck in their throats. It was not what I was expecting at all. And they look a little bit like guinea hens. Aside from the orange orb.
Right. Like, to me, they look like something you would see at the zoo.
Yes.
Like, not something that you would, like, eat for dinner. But anyway, another interesting fact about the prairie chicken meat is that it really was more like beef. Due to the higher levels of myoglobin, whatever in the world that is, and sounds like it had a really strong flavor. And the meat, I saw a picture of the meat, and it looks very dark.
Okay, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was kind of imagining this paired with the cornmeal hash. I was thinking like chicken and waffles kind of thing. But now that you say that, this does not sound like that.
No, I think it's a darker, more beefy tasting bird. And so, it would have been a darker gravy than what we're thinking.
Interesting.
And in the show notes, for your viewing pleasure... we will pop in a video about prairie chickens dancing and mating and carrying on.
That's very specific, Lorelei.
Yes. Well, the video is very specific, Jenny.
Oh, okay. You have one in mind. Okay. I can't see.
Oh, yes. We will have a link to that very video if you want to have like sort of a National Geographic moment, maybe with the children. Maybe not, depending on the age of your children. But I was transfixed by this video of prairie chickens.
Okay.
Which brings us to number four, bean porridge. Mm-hmm. And that was a clapping game, right? Bean porridge hot, bean porridge cold, bean porridge in the pot, 9 days old.
Oh, we always said peas porridge.
Right. That's a variation on bean porridge. And I think it depends where you live, in America or in England. Well, I don't know. I thought peas might have been the British version, but I could be wrong. But it just sounds very quaint. And this is a food I'm fascinated with among the foods eaten at the Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah. Tell us why.
Well, I'm fascinated because it sounds like, it just sounds really interesting. Like it sounds like it was a bean soup made from white navy beans and thickened with cornmeal and flavored with meat. So it was almost I don't know if you've ever put cornmeal dumplings in a stew or a soup or whatever. It just sounds like, I just wonder what it would taste like, because it's cornmeal is actually a thickener here. It's like beans and salt pork and cornmeal. Mm. And once again, cornmeal is just one of the, you know, main ingredients that they are eating here. And the recipe that I found says, half an hour before serving, dampen the cornmeal thoroughly with a few tablespoons of water and then stir slowly into the porridge.
Okay. Yeah. That sounds like a thickening.
Yes. And I'm just really curious to know what it will taste like. So I think I will try it at some point. So Jenny, what was the reference in the book to this, to bean porridge?
Let's see it. So I believe it's Laura saying, it was Laura. So she says, no supper was so good as the thick bean porridge flavored with a small bit of salt pork that Ma dipped onto the tin plates when Pa had come home cold and tired from his hunting.
Hmm.
It does sound like a delicious cold weather food.
Yeah, it does. It does. I like the thought of it. And now that I know what it is, it sounds better than... At first, I was picturing or thinking of like porridge, as we think of it, with beans in it. And that doesn't sound very good.
No, I think it's just like a bean stew. So this actually reminds me. So I don't know if you've ever heard, I think it's just called Sinnet bean soup. But when I worked in the Sinnet, well, it's always been a tradition that the food court downstairs in the basement has always serves a soup, a bean stew that sounds just like this. It's basically just cooked navy beans with salt pork. But it's like the one thing that they serve every single day. And that's been a tradition for, I don't know, like over 100 years or something.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
But so there's some like this
historic underpinnings there.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. So number five, stewed jackrabbit and dumplings.
Okay, so she says, Ma had cooked an especially good supper because they had company. There was stewed jackrabbit with white flour dumplings and plenty of gravy. There was a steaming hot, thick cornbread flavored with bacon fat. There was molasses to eat on the cornbread.
So rabbit. Have you had rabbit, Jenny?
I'm trying to think. I don't think I have, but I feel like I have, but I can't think of a time when I've had it. Have you?
Yes, I have. I've had it at least a couple of times. Years ago, the first time I ever visited with Doyle's family when we were dating, his grandma, his beloved grandma, made rabbit for Sunday lunch. So that was the first time I had ever had rabbit. And I was a little freaked out being a city girl. And then years later, Doyle and I went on our anniversary. We went to a really fancy restaurant in downtown Grand Rapids and we had rabbit fricassee.
Oh, I don't know what that is, but it sounds
It was
fancy.
Fricasseed, which I think kind of means like shredded or something. So
okay.
It was good. It was quite good. Although given a choice, usually I would not want to eat a rabbit. But that's just because I'm very much like very anthropomorphic, right? And I think of rabbits as having like tea parties in the forest. So I know I'm inconsistent, very inconsistent, but
no, that makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah. And I have a coworker actually who's a big hunter, and he gave us a giant slab of rabbit recently. And I went away for a week and I said to Doyle, I said, why don't you make the rabbit while I'm gone? And he did. And we have two Chinese international students living with us, and they both enjoyed it, and they're big eaters, and it was gone by the time I got
good.
Home.
That's perfect.
Yes. But I think rabbit would have been a big source of food for them. Mm-hmm. Rabbits were everywhere. They're still everywhere. Unlike prairie chickens, rabbits abound. And, you know, they're nowhere near extinct. In fact, there's probably too many of them. So rabbits were a real source of, you know, meat for them. And in Germany, this would be called Hasenpfeffer.
Ah, yes. Yeah.
I don't know if you remember the Bugs Bunny cartoon with, I don't know, Hasenpfeffer.
I don't.
Anyway. So that brings us to molasses.
Yes, molasses.
I'm totally fascinated with molasses. The amount of molasses in this book is insane. You know, I mean, I barely use it myself, but I hear I have some quotes from an article called Molasses's Bittersweet History by Jeff Hudson on the sfgate.com website. And he says, the Japanese, who know it as a specialty import, call it kuromitsu, literally black honey, a name that gives a good idea of how to use it. But we Americans call it molasses. There's a jar of it in most household kitchens, quietly gathering dust at the back of a cupboard. Typically, we use molasses once or twice a year when making gingerbread or baked beans.
Yep.
So when do you use molasses, Jenny?
I pretty much only use it when I'm making ginger cookies, mm-hmm. which is usually this time of year. I'm trying to think. I don't make baked beans, but I know my mom would use molasses in baked beans.
Oh.
But yeah, mm-hmm. it does gather dust, but
or barbecue sauce as well.
barbecue sauce. I also, mm-hmm. I haven't done this in a while, but I used to put it, like, blend it up with, what did I blend it with? I think coconut oil, and then pour it into coffee. And that is delicious.
Oh, wow. That does sound good. Well, it sounds like Ma and Pa used it in their coffee as a sweetener, unless company was over. And in that case, they would bring out their very limited sugar, white
well, what
sugar.
Do you know?
Yeah.
I guess I don't think of it as a sweetener because, it has a sweetness to it, but it's not like honey. So, and I also don't like overly sweet coffee, but it adds just enough sweetness. So, but there we go. But I wanted to read, I forgot, Lorelei, I think I shared this with you when we got it, but maybe not. But I'd forgotten that we got an email from a listener about molasses because we brought it up in a previous episode and we were both talking about that we found it a little odd that it was just used as like a spread on bread and a spread on bread. And so anyway, so a reader, I'll read it. Her name is Tara. Not a reader, a listener, a will-be reader, hopefully.
Yes.
But she says, I'm Canadian, originally from Newfoundland.
Woo!
And now living in Ontario. As you can guess, I'm a huge fan of Ann, and PEI is one of my favorite places to visit. As for molasses and bread, yes, people do eat molasses and bread, and it is exactly as it sounds. Molasses spread on top of a thick slice of homemade white bread. It is delicious. I'm Newfoundland. Is that how you say, how do you say it?
Newfoundland.
Newfoundland.
Sort of like some of the letters are sort of disappear. Newfoundland.
Newfoundland. Okay. So she says, I'm Newfoundland. We also pour molasses on, I don't know how to say it, Towtons or fried bread dough. Delicious.
Oh.
So.
Well, that does sound good.
Yeah, now I want to try it. I guess, yeah.
Well, thank you, Tara, my fellow Canadian.
That's right.
Very nice. Very nice to hear from her. What I found interesting when I did a deep dive into molasses is it was actually one of the things that the British taxed so heavily that it was one of the things that led to the American Revolution.
Oh, really? You always hear about tea, but molasses.
You always hear about tea, but I guess the Molasses Act, which added stiff tax to molasses imported to British colonies from the French West Indies, really started to annoy the American colonists. And it was one of the big things behind the American Revolution. So
interesting.
Molasses. Who knew?
Yeah. Such a troublemaker.
Yes, for sure. So today, I think molasses really evokes kind of a nostalgic image of grandma. And I think that's even the brand name, right? Of molasses, grandma's molasses.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Grandma's blackstrap.
Mm-hmm, we don't think of it as a modern ingredient at all. So maybe it's due for a comeback. Mm-hmm. But, it was used for baking and cooking and as a common table sweetener. So very interesting. And it's all over this book. And one thing it was used in is, as we've said, famously gingerbread. And something I picked up at the Little House on the Prairie gift shop is a recipe card for Laura's gingerbread. And I know we've talked about this before, but Laura was such a foodie in so many ways, and she wrote so beautifully and evocatively about food. And when her fans would write her like fan mail, she would write them back and she would tuck in her recipe for gingerbread.
That's right.
Which
that's
absolutely
so cute.
Love. And when we promote this episode, I'm going to give away a couple of those recipe cards, but I'm just going to run through the ingredients here. So 1 cup brown sugar blended with 1/2 cup shortening, 1 cup molasses mixed well with this, 2 teaspoons baking soda dissolved in 1 cup boiling water, 3 cups of flour, mix well. Add the following spices, 1 teaspoon ginger, cinnamon, allspice, nutmeg, cloves, and 1/2 teaspoon salt. Sift all into cake mixture and mix well. Add 2 well-beaten eggs, bake in a moderate oven for 30 minutes. Raisins, candied fruit, or chocolate frosting add to the goodness.
That sounds delicious. Interesting.
It does. I would not add any of those things. I would just eat it plain or with a nice vanilla icing. I don't see chocolate really going. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't think they need another flavor, but I do like it when they have a face, a little personality on my cookie.
Yes, for sure. And, you know, at Trader Joe's right now, they have the most delicious little iced gingerbread squares.
Oh, they're squares. Oh, okay.
Oh, my goodness. They are to die for. Really delicious. So, Trader Joe's, that was Laura's own recipe. Isn't that fun?
That is.
So molasses. So now that brings us to Christmas on the Little House on the Prairie. And I know we talked about some of this in our Christmas episode, but wow. I mean, this has to be one of the best, the most beautifully described Christmases and in all the heroine novels was the Christmas in Little House on the Prairie. So what did they eat at Christmas at the Little House on the Prairie, Jenny?
Well, the star of their feast was a turkey. Let's see. Ma says, or not Ma, I'm sorry. Laura says, they watched Ma dress the wild turkey, and it was a very fat turkey. They were lucky little girls to have a good house to live in and a warm fire to sit by and such a turkey for their Christmas dinner. Ma said so, and it was true. Ma said it was too bad that Santa Claus couldn't come this year, but he would surely come next year. That tells you a little bit about Ma's perspective there.
Like,
let's not focus on the fact that Santa's not coming, but how lucky are you that we have this turkey and a warm fire?
Right, right. She was always able to kind of gently, you know, remind them of how much they did have as opposed to emphasizing what they didn't have.
Right, like the fact that they were the only people for miles around. And, well, I guess Mr. Edwards was... He's the nearest neighbor in this book, right?
Yes.
He's the one that saves Christmas.
And also I read in Prairie Fires that the Tans, Dr. Tan and his family, live nearby as well.
Oh, that's right.
Yep. So, and what else? What else was, what other food stuffs were included at this Christmas celebration?
She mentions candy cane sticks, which I'm sure we will all recall. She says, something was shining bright in the top of Laura's stocking. She squealed and jumped out of bed. So did Mary, but Laura beat her to the fireplace, and the shining thing was a glittering new tin cup. Mary had one exactly like it. Then they plunged their hands into the stockings again, and they pulled out 2 long, long sticks of candy. It was peppermint candy, striped red and white. They looked and looked at the beautiful candy. I love that. I love how...
I know. Like,
I think it's just like all of the Little House books just make you look at the simplest things with fresh eyes. But I mean, peppermint candy is like the most commonplace. Like my kids don't even like it, but they just make it sound so dreamy and
so special.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then they also... It was. I know. And so simple. They just had 2 items in their stocking. And then they also had, oh, no, I guess not 2. Then they also had heart-shaped cakes made by Ma. Laura says, those stockings weren't empty yet. Mary and Laura pulled out 2 small packages. They unwrapped them and each found a little heart-shaped cake. Over their delicate brown tops was sprinkled white sugar. The sparkling grains lay like tiny drifts of snow. It had been made of pure white flour and sweetened with white sugar. The cakes were too pretty to eat. Mary and Laura just looked at them. But at last, Laura turned hers over and she nibbled a tiny nibble from underneath where it wouldn't show. And the inside of that little cake was white.
Oh,
foods would have been a rare treat because the white sugar was not used often. That was saved primarily for company, I believe.
I know. And I just think like, you know, I'm getting stocking stuffers for my kids now. And, you know, I just think of them, especially when they were little, like putting, you know, a little wrapped cake. I mean, you know, they might like it, but it just seems so, so different from what we stuff our stockings with now. And
right.
I, I love that. The idea of this very special white cake made with white flour, sweetened with white sugar. It was just so rare, you know, that they would only eat it once a year at Christmas. So
mm-hmm.
very special.
Yes. And when you only get three things in your stocking, you look at them a little bit differently, I would imagine.
Yes. And so Barbara Walker, the author of The Little House Cookbook, notes that because Ma would not have had eggs or baking powder, these cakes would have been something between a sugar cookie and shortbread. She would have had milk, but probably no butter. So she would have used lard. Mm. And so Barbara Walker's recipe in The Little House Cookbook calls for buttermilk, flour, sugar, baking soda, nutmeg, and lard. So that actually sounds really good.
It does. That sounds like a shortbread cookie, which are some of my absolute favorites. Yum.
Yeah, I love shortbread. My mom used to make the best shortbread. So that to me is Christmassy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, which food from the Little House on the Prairie would you most like to eat or try, Jenny?
Well, I guess I just really love cookies because the gingerbread recipe sounds delicious. And then I would also love to make this one we just mentioned, the shortbread hearts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How about you?
I think the one that intrigues me the most is the bean porridge.
Mm, that does sound really
surprisingly
good.
Yeah. It's you know, getting cold in Michigan and it just sounds really cozy, and beans and pork and, you know, just kind of a hearty dish. So that's the one that I would like to try.
Mm.
I think I would also like to try using molasses in my coffee.
Oh, yes, you should.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. See how that tastes. Which brings us to our heroine challenge. And my heroine challenge to you, Jenny, is I challenge you to make something unexpected with molasses.
Oh, okay. Unexpected. So not my usual go-tos. Okay.
Right. So not gingerbread.
Right. Or in my coffee. Okay.
Or molasses cookies. Or
right. Those are so different. Okay. Let's see. And I would challenge you then to maybe make some of the fried cornbread. Or I guess it's not fried cornbread, but the fried cornmeal mush.
Oh,
in really? Bear grease, if you could.
Oh,
maybe the challenge is just acquire some bear grease.
Right, right.
Because if anyone can do it, you can.
apparently I have a hookup, so... Which is just crazy, right? Anyway, yes, I shall consult my cousin Tracy and say, did you, cousin Tracy, keep the bear grease from your daughter's kill from last year? If so, could you mail it to Michigan?
It shouldn't be a problem.
It should not be a problem. Which brings us then to our next episode. We are excited about our next episode, which will focus on one of our favorite topics, casual hospitality. We call it pinafore hospitality. And a pinafore is an old-fashioned apron for every day, or in today's terms, my beloved Winnipeg Jets leggings.
Interchangeable.
Interchangeable. Just something you would wear every day. So what is something every day that you would wear, Jenny?
Jeans. I'm a
jeans
wearing. Well, no, you know what? I would wear an apron. I love aprons.
Okay.
I have vintage aprons. And I think it's just because, yeah, then I don't have to change. I can just wear whatever I'm wearing and then wear an adorable apron on top of it. So, yeah.
Well, that's
I feel
adorable.
Free and in
so
an apron.
You, Jenny.
Oh, thank you.
I actually found a vintage apron with sloths on it.
Ooh.
It's very cute. Or as the British say, sloth.
Do they say? I did not know that. What?
They do. They say sloth.
Oh, that's funny.
I love it. I'm obsessed with British people and the way they talk. And if I should ever go there, I'm going to make such a nuisance of myself. I'll be like, everyone will be like, oh, good grief. This lady is hanging on my every word.
Nothing they haven't seen before, I'm sure.
No, nothing they have not seen before. That's very true. And in regards to our hospitality episode, our star heroine will be none other than Betsy of the beloved Betsy Tacy series by Maude Hart Lovelace.
Yay.
And for our listeners, get ready to tie one on, a pinafore that is, and talk about all things hospitable and heroines. Yay.
It's going to be fun. If you liked this episode, will you do us a big favor and go to iTunes and leave us a review to help others find us and know what we're all about? We would really appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed this episode. We will see you next time.
Bye.